Now, Mike Johnson has been badgering me. He wants me to address head on the issue of the coronavirus pandemic, and in particular, what God is saying to us through it. And each time he has raised this matter with me, I've fobbed him off in some way or other, but you can only resist Mike's badgering for so long. And this morning, then, I'm finally capitulating. I suspect some of you will be inwardly groaning at this point. Every newspaper article, every radio program, every conversation over the garden hedge involves analyzing the pandemic, and now we can't even get away from it at a Sunday morning worship service. You may be thinking like that, and if so, I sympathize somewhat with such thoughts. I suspect others of you, however, will share Mike's sense that God might be saying something to us. In particular, perhaps you've heard the J word being bandied about in Christian circles, judgment. And you're wondering whether or not that is right, whether or not COVID-19 is an eruption of divine judgment. Well, let me say at the outset that I have a reluctance when thinking about this pandemic to reach quickly for that word judgment. I'll give you a couple of reasons for that. There are probably more I could mention, but I'll give you a couple. First of all, I believe passionately in the great Reformation principle, sola scriptura, scripture alone. That means that the way God speaks to us is through the Bible, not through viruses, not through pandemics, through the Bible. This book is where we hear his voice. Now, the situation is a bit more nuanced than that, because God also speaks through the creation, and he speaks to us through the Lord's Supper. So this principle then of the Bible alone, it isn't quite as straightforward as it initially sounds. But you see, this is the crucial thing. It's the Bible that tells us that God speaks through the creation and through the Lord's Supper. And in fact, it's the Bible that tells us exactly what God is saying through creation and through the Lord's Supper. So at a communion service, I can stand at the table and announce, God is saying to you through this wine, my son's blood has been poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I can do that because of the Bible, because of Matthew 26, 28. Or standing at this lectern this morning, I could tell you all to look out of your window, and I could announce, God is saying to you through the sky and the birds and the trees, I am a God of great power. I could do that because of the Bible, because of Romans 1, 20. But standing here this morning, I couldn't announce, God is saying to you through COVID-19, I am very angry about same-sex marriage, or I am very angry about abortion, or whatever. I couldn't do that because the Bible never mentions COVID-19 at all, let alone a link between COVID-19 and same-sex marriage or something. So I'm saying then, in the first place, my belief in sola scriptura makes me reluctant. It may sound terribly impressive when a Christian preacher or writer makes a grand statement about the very specific thing God is doing or God is saying through current events, and lots of people will celebrate this prophetic voice in the church. But actually, all that preacher or writer is doing is speculating wildly. We don't need prophetic voices in the church. Prophetic voices ended a couple of millennia ago. What we need in the church is more voices willing to be silent because they don't know what God is doing, but are happy just to trust that the God who sacrificed his own son at Calvary does all things well. And then a second reason for my reluctance, I'm cautioned by Acts 16. I'm cautioned by Acts 16. In Acts 16, Paul is in Philippi. Now, I want you to imagine a Christian in Antioch, a member of Paul's sending church, a Christian in Antioch as the events in Philippi in Acts 16 are unfolding. And that Christian then is about to go to bed one night, but before he does so, he checks his emails. Now, I know there weren't any emails in the first century, but just play along with me for a moment. He checks his emails. And there in his inbox then, there's an urgent prayer request that has come through. Paul is in trouble with the Philippian authorities. He and Silas have been arrested and they've been beaten and they have been thrown into prison. And so that Christian in Antioch climbs into bed that night, heavy-hearted, greatly worried about Paul and Silas. He gets up early the next morning, goes straight to his computer, but before he's had a chance to log into his emails to see if there's any new prayer update about Paul, as soon as he's just opened his internet browser, his attention is drawn to a news headline that has flashed up on the screen. There's been an earthquake in Philippi. He clicks on the story. It's a big earthquake. Buildings have been seriously damaged. It's too early to say, but it's likely a lot of people have lost their lives. This Christian in Antioch, he gets up from his desk and wanders out into the garden trying to process all this. His first thought is, I wonder if Paul and Silas are okay, if they've survived this disaster. But another thought is also in his head. A thought that's gaining strength with every passing minute, a powerful, deeply felt conviction, and it's this. That earthquake is God's judgment. God's judgment on a city wicked enough to begin with its paganism and its lucrative fortune-telling industry and all the rest of it, and God's judgment on a city that has now dared to imprison the foremost ambassador of the Christian gospel. To that guy in his back garden in Antioch, it's as clear as day, it's as obvious as 2 add 2 is 4, that earthquake in Philippi is God's judgment. Is that how you and I think about that earthquake in Philippi in Acts 16? Well, it's not, is it? Why? Well, because we never encountered it as a news story on the BBC. We never saw the mountainous piles of rubble in Philippi's streets. We never heard the sirens blaring through the night. We never saw the city's A&E unit stretched beyond their capacity. We never witnessed the bodies being lined up in makeshift morgues. If we had seen and heard and smelt the devastation in Philippi that night, we might well have reached for the judgment word. But all we have is Luke's account. And Luke doesn't present it in terms of judgment at all. Luke presents it in terms of that pursuing, irresistible Christ that we considered a couple of Sunday mornings ago. And Christ has already chased down one Philippian that he wants to convert, Lydia, and he has opened her heart. And now there's another Philippian that he wants to convert, the jailer, and he's going to get it. And if it requires an earthquake to get that man down on his knees crying, what must I do to be saved? Then Christ will do whatever it takes. That's how Luke presents it. And it's worth at least asking the question then. If Luke, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, were documenting this coronavirus pandemic, would he focus on the devastation, the lives and livelihoods lost, and so highlight the solemn judgment of God? Or would he focus on all the unbelievers converted and all the backsliders restored as a result of this pandemic, and so highlight the irresistible grace of Christ and the fact Christ will use a deadly virus to build his church, if that is what it takes? It's an unanswerable question. And certainly I'm not trying to minimize the devastation that coronavirus has caused, because that's very real and should evoke compassion in all of us. All I'm saying is, let's not be too hasty to reach for that word judgment. So those are two areas of reluctance that I have there. But am I saying then that the word judgment is completely inappropriate and completely off limits when discussing the pandemic? Well, no. Certainly, I'm not prepared to announce COVID-19 as God's direct judgment on some specific evil blighting the world or the church, because that would be conjecture and would violate the principle of sola scriptura. And I'm not prepared to give the impression that judgment is the only thing or necessarily the main thing that God is doing in this pandemic, because that would be to fail to learn the lesson of Acts 16. However, I am prepared to accept that all calamities are at least in part God's judgment on a sinful world. And the present calamity then, this pandemic, is no exception. I think the part of the Bible where that comes across most clearly is the book of Revelation. Revelation is quite a repetitive book, and I don't say that disparagingly. Repetition is good. It drives home important truths. But it means that there are a number of passages actually in this book of Revelation that we could go to this morning, but we're going to go to part of the one I read a few minutes ago. We're going to go to Revelation chapter 8, verses 6 to 12. Revelation 8, verses 6 to 12. Here we have four angels blowing trumpets. And with each trumpet blast, calamities occur within the world. And those calamities, as we shall see, are divine judgments. And having established that then, just in the remaining time we have, I want to draw to your attention three things. And first of all, the chronology of these judgments. The chronology of these judgments. So I said that in these verses we're looking at, verses 6 to 12, there are four trumpet blasts. But if you carry on reading Revelation, there are more than four, there are seven altogether. The fifth and sixth are in chapter 9. The seventh is later, it's at the end of chapter 11. And the seventh is important. The calamity that occurs when trumpet number 7 is blown is the final judgment, the time for the dead to be judged. That's what it says in chapter 11, verse 18. And that's the key, I think, to understanding the previous six trumpets. If trumpet 7 is the final judgment at the end of history, then trumpets 1 to 6 are the final judgment beginning early, as it were, within history. They are advanced, premature flashes of the final judgment. If trumpet 7 is about the dead being judged, as that verse I just read in chapter 11 says, then trumpets 1 to 6 are about the living being judged. With these trumpets, the end has not yet come. The present age is still in full flow. The day hasn't arrived for the proper outpouring of God's wrath. That lies in the future. These are merely the first distant rumblings of that outpouring, the faint anticipations of what is to come. I suppose, in a way, this is the flip side of a truth that we're more familiar with. We all know that, for want of a better term, some of the positive aspects of the end have broken into history already in these last days. So at the end, we, God's people, are going to be made perfectly holy and ushered into a world where holiness is the all-pervading reality. But in our lives and in our church communities, something of that coming holiness has broken in already. I talked about this the other Wednesday evening. Our love for brothers and sisters in Christ, our sexual purity, our contentment, our humility, these are premature flashes, if you like, of a way of living that properly belongs to the end. And so just as some of the positive aspects of the end have broken into history already in these last days, similarly, some of the negative aspects of the end have broken into history already in these last days. At the end, God is going to execute judgment and inflict wrath. But in the calamities that presently occur, something of that coming judgment and wrath has broken in already. So with regard to our text this morning then, Revelation 8, 6 to 12, and these trumpet blasts, these judgments, what's the chronology? When are these judgments happening? I'm saying they're happening now. They're happening now. The judgments in this passage are present age judgments, present age anticipations of the greater judgment to come. That's what we're dealing with here. That's the chronology of these judgments. But then notice with me, secondly, the contours of these judgments. The contours of these judgments. So when it comes to what these judgments actually look like, so far I've simply used the fairly vague term calamities. But we need to ask, what are the more specific contours of these judgments? So that we can then see whether or not the current pandemic has points of contact with this passage. And it seems to me that two features of these judgments here particularly need to be noted. One is obvious, the other not so obvious. So first of all, the unraveling of creation. The unraveling of creation. That's the obvious feature of these judgments in our passage. And it's a logical feature. In the light of what we've said already this morning, we've said that these present age judgments are simply premature eruptions of the final judgment. Now, according to 2 Peter 3, the final judgment will involve the creation being dismantled. The heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. 2 Peter 3, verse 10. The final judgment will involve the creation being dismantled, and so then, these present age judgments, in those present age judgments, it's already starting to unravel. I mean, the details in our passage may not always be crystal clear, but you can hardly miss, can you, that in trumpet 1, verse 7, the earth and what grows out of the earth is being thrown into disarray. In trumpet 2, verses 8 and 9, we have devastation and death affecting the sea. In trumpet 3, verses 10 and 11, it's the world's freshwater supplies that have become dysfunctional. And then in trumpet 4, verse 12, the focus shifts to regions of the universe beyond our planet. And there too, in the realm of the sun and the moon and the stars, things are going wrong also. And so, as I say, although the precise details may be a little bit unclear at points, the overall picture here is unmistakable. In these judgments, creation is in small ways unraveling in anticipation of the final judgment when everything will completely fall apart. It's not difficult to think, is it, of contemporary examples then of this unraveling? Things like bushfires and floods and droughts and hurricanes. When these occur, I don't think we should start talking about the particular sinfulness of those people who are directly in the firing line, as it were, for the reason that I set out in my introduction. But we may talk like this. We may say, this is a sinful world in persistent rebellion against God. And soon there's going to be a colossal day of reckoning, a day of wrath, a day of cosmic, history-ending divine judgment. That judgment will see the very creation dismantled. And this bushfire then, or this flood, or this drought, or this hurricane, it's of a piece with that coming event. It's not unrelated. It's this sinful world getting a small taste now of what awaits it on a vastly bigger scale further down the line. And what about COVID-19 then? Is it an expression of the creation already starting to unravel? Well, not as obviously, perhaps, as a bushfire or a flood or a drought or a hurricane. But I think in its own way it is. A virus that has come into the human race from the animal world. I mean, that's a pretty clear-cut violation, is it not, of how this creation is supposed to work. Men are supposed to be in control of the animals. That's how God arranged things at the beginning. Man ruling over them. That's the order, that's the structure that's built into the creation. And when, therefore, the animals cause damage and death to man, whether it's in a very direct way like a lion attacking a human being, or whether it's in a less direct way like a virus passing from bats to humans, that is creation going badly wrong. That is creation unraveling. So, yes, COVID-19 is this sinful world getting a small taste now of what awaits it on a vastly bigger scale further down the line. But if the unraveling of creation is the obvious feature then of the judgments in our passage, we need to now notice to the less obvious feature, and it's this, the unraveling of idols. There's the unraveling of creation, but there's also the unraveling of idols. And again, this is logical. I read to you earlier this morning, Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah there is looking ahead to the final judgment, and he singles out one particular aspect of that event, namely the destruction of man's idols. There was that refrain there, the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. That is the Lord as opposed to the idols who throughout history have been wickedly and ridiculously exalted in God's place. And there are also in that passage then phrases like this, all that is lifted up shall be brought low, verse 12. The idols shall utterly pass away, verse 18. In that day, mankind will cast away their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs from before the terror of the Lord. So you get the picture there. The future judgment, the final judgment, according to Isaiah, will involve the destruction of man's idols. And so then, in these present age judgments, I'm saying, they are already starting to unravel. Now, you might be thinking, well, okay, we can see that that's logical, but we can't see how that's particularly relevant to Revelation chapter 8. You might be thinking that. Well, I said that this feature of the judgments in our passage isn't obvious. But I think it's there for the careful reader who's attuned to the language and imagery of Revelation and indeed of the Bible generally. It's there. Let me show you. Look at the detail in verse 7 of Revelation 8. At the end there, all green grass was burned up. Now, as a Bible reader, what should green grass make us think of? Well, of course, the psalm that we sang earlier this morning. He in pastures green grass, he leadeth me. What's the significance of the green grass there in Psalm 23? Well, for a sheep, of course, green grass signifies total satisfaction, the fulfillment of its deepest desires. And the point in the psalm is that God gives that. God gives total satisfaction. God gives the fulfillment of your deepest desires. But what do sinful human beings do? Well, they seek that total satisfaction, that fulfillment of their deepest desires elsewhere, in all the wrong places. They create their own artificial green grass. That's what idols are. Whether the literal kind, the statues with faces in a temple somewhere, or the non-literal kind, like money and possessions and those kinds of things. Idols are counterfeit green grass. And verse 7 here is talking about that green grass then being burned up. These idols that men have created failing and unraveling now, already, in the present age. That's what the verse is talking about. So then you jump to verse 10. And there in verse 10, you have springs of water being poisoned and ruined. Now, springs of water in the Bible have a similar significance to green grass. Again, they signify that total satisfaction that only God can truly provide. Indeed, they've been mentioned just a few verses earlier, chapter 7, verse 17. There it's the idea of Christ guiding his people to springs of living water. Christ throughout eternity leading his people to deeper and deeper satisfaction in God. But again, you see, what do sinful human beings do? Well, they seek it elsewhere. They create their own counterfeit springs of water, idols, in other words. And this verse then, like verse 7, is talking about those idols being ruined and unraveling already in the present age. Or look at verse 9. And there we have an interesting reference to the ships being destroyed. Now, a few chapters later, ships will be mentioned again with a particular association in chapter 18, verses 17 to 19. Ships will be associated with those who live for the accumulation of wealth. In that first century context, the shipping trade was very lucrative and thus a hotbed for such people, people who lived for the accumulation of wealth. And doubtless ships in this verse, here in chapter 8, have that same kind of association. We are meant to connect ships here with the pursuit of the idol of wealth and prosperity. And this verse, again, is talking about that idol being destroyed, unraveling already in this present age. So I hope you see what I'm saying here then. When we see creation in small ways unraveling now, such things are premature rumblings of the final judgment. And similarly, when we see man's idols in small ways unraveling now, such things are also premature rumblings of the final judgment. And surely, I don't need to convince you that in this pandemic, we have seen man's idols unraveling. I mean, remember that when we talk about idols in our Western context, we're not necessarily talking about things that are bad in themselves, but we're talking about things that are used badly. Ultimate fulfillment is being sought in them instead of in God. So for millions then, millions of people today, money, riches is an idol. What has happened in this pandemic? Economies have crashed right, left and center. For many, exotic holidays are an idol. What has happened in the pandemic? All foreign travel has been stopped. For many, professional football is an idol. What has happened in the pandemic? All cancelled. And so we could go on. Counterfeit green grass being burned up. Counterfeit springs of water being ruined. Idols unraveling all around us. It's a sinful world getting a small taste now of Isaiah 2, of what awaits it on a vastly bigger scale further down the line. So, the chronology of these judgments, the contours of these judgments, but then thirdly and briefly, the comfort of these judgments, the comfort of these judgments, and two comforts then. As we close, first of all, notice that these judgments are limited. They're limited. That repeated reference to a third, verse 7, a third of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees. verse 9, a third of the living creatures, a third of the ships. And so it goes on again and again. A third, a third, a third. You know, like all numbers and fractions in the book of Revelation, we're not meant to take these literally. The point is that these judgments in the present age, while significant, are always limited. And this is comforting then in relation to the creation unraveling. It's really just reaffirming, I suppose, what Genesis 8, verse 22 says. Remember God's promise there to Noah and for the benefit of all who come after Noah. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. In other words, God is saying there that at the macro level, at the level of the big picture, at the level of seasons and harvest, day and night, at that level, there will be from now on until the end of time an unshakable normality. Yes, at the lower level, at the smaller level, at the micro level, there will be calamities. And sometimes, if you're in the midst of those calamities, they will feel very big indeed. But those calamities will never disrupt that unshakable normality at the macro level. And that's true then of this pandemic. And we can be comforted by that in the face of this pandemic. Yes, we're using this word unprecedented all the time. And yes, it's changing our lives perhaps in ways that we never expected our lives to be changed and all the rest of it. But those things that God spoke of in Genesis 8:22 still remain the same. And lots of other things besides. There's still an unshakable normality, isn't there, about this creation? Even as we see it in small ways unraveling as a premature eruption of the final judgment. The tide on Tynemouth Beach keeps coming in and going out again. The grass in your garden keeps growing. The birds keep nesting and singing and having their chicks. The world keeps on going. Day follows night. The sun rises and sets. There's an unshakable normality because God's promise in Genesis 8:22 will not be broken. No earthquake, no volcano, no global warming, no virus pandemic. Nothing will override the promise of Genesis 8:22. That unshakable normality will continue until Jesus Christ appears in the skies. And that's a comforting thing that we can rest in this morning. But then the second comfort, remember again that these judgments in the present age are intimately related then to the final judgment. That's why here in Revelation, they're all presented as trumpets. They're a unit. They're a series, a sequence that go together. Now, how as Christians should we think of the final judgment? We know, of course, that it's a solemn prospect. And it's right to think of it as a solemn prospect. And to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ with all the urgency that such a solemn prospect should lend to our preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But is there any sense in which the final judgment is a welcome, desirable prospect for us as Christians? Well, yes, there is. Much more than we usually recognize, I think. We talked about this last Sunday evening in connection with Psalm 58. And here then, it ought to be obvious because of this trumpet imagery. Where is that coming from, this trumpet imagery? Remember that much of Revelation is borrowing the language and imagery of the Old Testament. Where's this trumpet imagery coming from? Well, surely it's coming from the Jericho account. There you remember you have on that final day, seven blasts of trumpet, and then the fall of Jericho. In other words, then, the seventh trumpet here in Revelation, the final judgment, is being equated with the fall of Jericho, there in that iconic Old Testament narrative. Now, is the fall of Jericho a somber, sad event? Of course it's not. It's one that we love to tell our children about. We love that story, don't we? It's a great event because as Jericho falls, the people of God are able to flood into the promised land and claim their inheritance at last. And that's exactly the sense you get in Revelation 11. I actually referred to this passage last Lord's Day evening. As the seventh trumpet blasts, yes, it's solemn and the time for the dead to be judged has come. God's wrath has come. The destroying of the destroyers of the earth has come. But at the same time, there's that great cry in Revelation 11:15, the kingdom of the world has now become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. So, the final judgment then is solemn in many respects, but from another angle, it is the day when God's judgment falling on this old idolatrous order, a new age will dawn in its place. And as we saw last Sunday evening, the earth itself will be renewed. And we, God's people, will flood in and claim our inheritance. It's a welcome prospect. It's a glorious prospect. It's like the fall of Jericho. We will be like the Israelites on that day when that trumpet sounded and the walls crashed down and they saw victory written all over the sky. And that will be our experience on the last day. And whenever, therefore, we experience now in the present age calamities, we should hear in our minds trumpets sounding, trumpets 1 to 6 being sounded. And it should remind us we're on the way to the seventh trumpet. These are the warm-up acts. These are the necessary stages on the way to that final trumpet sounding, when we shall claim our inheritance. And so there's, in an indirect way, there's something comforting for us in the calamities, creation unraveling, man's idols unraveling. It's saying to us, this scheme of Revelation 8 to 11 is still on track. It's going ahead just as God promised there in Revelation it would. And everything is working toward that day when the seventh trumpet will sound. The walls of this world's fortress will fall, and we, God's people, bought through the blood of Christ, will enter that situation that we read of this evening in Revelation 7, this morning in Revelation 7, where we will be led by the Lamb in a realm where there'll be no more tears, where we'll be protected from the scorching heat, from hunger. That is all the symptoms of the curse and all the present judgments. There'll be no more of those. There'll be a perfect world that we'll inhabit with God's people, led by the Lamb, in the presence of the triune God. These little trumpet blasts now should remind us that is where we are heading. May God comfort us then in the face of these present judgments. Amen. Well, we're going to close singing just